very few state elected officials can stir the kind of emotional response at the mere mention of their name, not just at home but around the country, as Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach. In his two terms, the Republican lawyer has crusaded for changes to state election and voter ID laws. He's fought federal court battles and been cited for contempt. He's sought and received prosecutorial powers in cases of voter fraud. And, of course, he's been an apparently influential advisor to President Trump. It's all sort of surprising, since voters in Kansas, and probably in most other states, in most years, can't even name who their Secretary of State is. Now that Kobach's running for governor, and a slew of candidates are seeking to take his place in the Secretary of State's office, it's a good time to step back and ask, what is this job anyway, and how has Kobach fundamentally changed it? Joining us to consider those questions are Michael Smith. He's chair of the Political Science Department at Emporia State. Michael, welcome.
Good morning.
It's good to have you here. And also Hunter Woodall, who covers Kansas government for the Kansas City Star. Hunter, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, we're joined by Celia Yopis-Jepson, who is a reporter for the Kansas News Service, which is a reporting collaboration based here at KCUR. Hi, Celia.
Good morning.
So let's start at the most basic level, Michael. At the national level, we know Secretary of State is this big, important international diplomatic job. Most states have a Secretary of State who does something with a much lower profile usually, right?
That's right. First of all, just so I don't have irate colleagues when I get to work, it is the Social Sciences Department at ESU, multidisciplinary.
Thank you.
But no worries.
I reduced your portfolio to just politics. I apologize.
No worries. Speaking of politics, right, internal politics. But as far as your question, Kris Kobach is actually not the first person to get there in Kansas. Kris Kobach has always reminded me of Phil Klein.
Yes.
The former Attorney General of Kansas, served one term, was elected in the early 2000s. And he really pioneered this idea, at least in the 21st century, of taking this workhorse state office that's not the governorship. It's typically associated with being pretty low-key. Well, the Attorney General does get some publicity, to be fair. But it's typically the kind of job where it's kind of like the water or the electricity. It's there, we take it for granted, and we only notice when they do something wrong.
Because they've got certain responsibilities assigned to them by the Constitution, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And state constitutions tend to be pretty detailed on that.
Like what?
The fact that office is even described, for example. In the U.S. Constitution, there's no mention of the president's cabinet. It's just a tradition. But state constitutions tend to spell out those offices and those duties, and that includes Attorney General and Secretary of State. And I just wanted to mention that that Klein took the Attorney General's office and got this national publicity, got before the Supreme Court, although they turned back a decision he made without comment. But he did get national publicity for it, a very anti-abortion. Kobach is now doing that with the Secretary of State's office and anti-immigration.
Yeah, Hunter Woodall, in an ordinary time, what is the Secretary of State assigned to do? What's the baseline set of responsibilities for the Secretary of State?
So essentially, they manage elections, they manage business entities. You know, it's a very, like I said, more of a clerical, low-key job. This is something that's, you know, very much, you know, plugged into the engine of the state, but it's not necessarily a political position unless you make it so. And, you know, as we talked about, as Michael said, Kobach, you know, in the same way that Phil Klein did, has made this a very political office, and you kind of see this nationwide now. I mean, I can't tell you how many days I see a statement or, you know, some publicity from the California Secretary of State. So it seems to be a national trend now that Secretaries of State are becoming much more plugged into being, you know, political officials rather than your typical workhorse or, you know, just part of the political engine.
Well, and Celia, you've been covering the current race, which we'll talk about in a little bit to replace Kris Kobach as Secretary of State. But it is undeniably a political position on a certain level, right? I mean, you run as a Republican or a Democrat, and often these candidates end up appearing on the ballot for future offices.
Yeah, and certainly, I mean, it's a statewide office. So, you know, if you're campaigning for this office, you're traveling around the state, you're getting your name out there in a much broader way than running for I don't want to say just, that sounded like it, you know. But, you know, a House district, that's your local area. I mean, this is statewide campaigning.
And so a candidate who is elected Secretary of State or even who runs for Secretary of State is getting a lot of exposure that could pay off down the road if they want to run for, say, governor or U.S. Senate.
You could argue that.
I want to ask all of you, there was a column in the Kansas City Star last year by Dave Helling, who argued that if he were Secretary of State, the first thing he would do is clean up elections. And the second thing you would do is abolish the office of Secretary of State. A few states have done that, assigned those administrative tasks to other offices. Michael Smith, is there value in having a statewide elected office holder doing this kind of work?
You know, it's an old political argument. The progressive reformers of the early 20th century favored what they called a short ballot instead of a long ballot. Fewer elected offices, fewer opportunities for machines like the Pendergast machine here mm-hmm. to mess around and to encourage straight ticket voting and things like that. And certainly with the Secretary of State's office pre-Kobach, almost all those secretaries of state have been Republicans, and there's a good reason for that. Kansas is a Republican-leaning state, occasionally votes for a Democrat, but when voters have never heard of any of the candidates, they default to the party label. So while you'll have a high-publicity Democrat every now and then, a Dennis Moore, a Kathleen Sebelius, maybe a few getting elected this year for Congress or possibly governor, because of the publicity for the candidate, when you go to those down-ballot races, it's really any really competitive election is likely to be in the Republican primary, although not necessarily this year.
Which we will talk about very soon. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. We're talking about the Kansas Secretary of State's office, how it has changed under the current office holder, Kris Kobach, and what the implications of that might be for the future. I'm talking with Hunter Woodall of the Kansas City Star, Celia Yopis Jepson of the Kansas News Service, and Michael Smith of Emporia State University. Hunter, let's talk about how Kobach has used this office differently, perhaps, than in the past. The office is ordinarily low profile, we've said, but these last 7.5 years have not exactly been ordinary.
Exactly. And I mean, I think the great way to think of it is, you know, the Secretary of State's office was like a car on a rural highway, and Kobach took it and went 100, is now going 100 miles per hour on a high, you know, on a down I-70 now. I mean, you know, in the time that he's been Secretary of State, you know, the big thing was passing the SAFE Act, you know, which of course requires voter ID, and it did require proof of citizenship. Obviously, that was struck down earlier this year by Judge Julie Robinson here in, you know, Kansas City, Kansas. But also, I believe it was back in 2015, he was granted a prosecutorial power to prosecute voter fraud, which that's kind of been really how he's made his mark nationally. And it's things like that that led him to become, you know, the effective leader of President Donald Trump's Voter Fraud Commission.
Do you know how many cases of voter fraud he has actually prosecuted?
You know, it's funny you asked that. I had called earlier to check with his office, and they did not get me an answer until I got back. I mean, I know at some point last year there had been 9 convictions. They seem to think it was a little bit higher than that, but I didn't get a final number before coming on.
So at least 9. Celia, you've spent part of the last year covering that trial that Hunter mentioned. Remind us what he was accused exactly of doing.
Well, okay, so this all centered around Kansas's requirement that you provide documentation of your citizenship if you want to register to vote in Kansas. So that ended up with him being sued by the League of Women Voters and other people represented by lawyers from the ACLU who said, okay, you've blocked tens of thousands of voter applications for no legitimate reason. And the arguments were that he was violating federal law on voter registration and also the U.S. Constitution. And in fact, in the end, the plaintiffs won and struck down his law, or that part of it.
And along the way, they also cited him and or his office for contempt, right?
That's right. The trial back in March took place over, I think 3 weeks it was, and it ended with this very dramatic kind of intense contempt hearing where he was in fact held in contempt, and that had to do with his office not carrying out orders that had come down along the way from the federal judge regarding getting people fully registered to vote.
So, Michael, when an official adds to their job, sort of goes beyond what is required and takes on more, as it appears Kris Kobach has done, is that illegal? Is that wrong? Or is that just something they're free to do? Is it just different?
Redefining the job is not illegal because, as you pointed out, there are duties spelled out in the state constitution. As long as you fulfill those, you've not done anything impeachable. It's really up to the voters. Now, that's a different question from the citations of Kobach's behavior that he did not follow court directions. That is an issue. But redefining an office, no, it's not unconstitutional. One question I do have, though, it's more of a subjective question, is those boring things that the Secretary of State does, like register businesses, register securities offerings, and apart from the arguments about voter fraud, just maintaining up-to-date voter rolls, things that Bill Graves, for example, did very well, Secretary of State, very low-key. With Kobach seeking so much publicity and spending so much time on immigration, are those jobs getting done, and are they getting done well?
Well, that's a good question. Hunter Woodall, I mean, as Kris Kobach makes the rounds of national TV and of trips to Washington, D.C. for this this voter fraud investigating committee that didn't that has now gone out of existence, I mean, is there a sense that the baseline job is being done?
Well, I think definitely his critics have kind of slammed him for that. You often see Democrats being very critical of how he's handled the job, especially like John Carmichael, a state rep from Wichita. To Kobach's credit, you know, his defense of this has been, I believe, especially with the Voter Fraud Commission, was, oh, it takes about as much time as if I'd picked up golf or something like that. That's often been the defense line. You get the sense, though, he does work very hard. I mean, I don't think anybody could say that Kobach doesn't work hard. But, you know, I'd love to see how he spends a normal day, because I can't imagine there's much sleeping in there.
Right. And I guess we do have to say it is not as though he does this job by himself. There's a large staff of the Secretary of State, right, to carry out those more ministerial functions. Celia?
Yeah, absolutely. But you are right that people have been seizing on anything that is not functioning, you know, as well as it could be at the Secretary of State's office, as evidence that Kobach is not doing a good job. And honestly, those same critics seized on the many times during the trial in March that Kobach kind of got, you know, slapped on the wrist, mm-hmm. for not knowing the rules of the courtroom and such, as well as his legal team should have. There was kind of, you know, that kind of contributed to this argument of this man is not handling the office with the level of competence that we would like to see.
Well, I'm gonna challenge you a little bit on that. There is a staff. It's not that large. Mm-hmm. I've been to the Secretary of State's office suite in Topeka, and it's just a few rooms. He has a handful of people that work for him. A lot of his job is delegating, particularly on the voter registration, which is actually done at the county level.
Right, which again, in many cases, has led some people to wonder what the job, why the state office has taken on such prominence with regard to voters. You know, I want to see if we can put this in context of the national, in the context of other states. Almost every state has a Secretary of State. Most are elected, just as they are in Kansas. Very rarely you hear about a Secretary of State. I remember in the year 2000, to jump all the way back there to the Bush versus Gore election counting, the Florida Secretary of State became a prominent figure for a time, the Ohio Secretary of State in another presidential election. But that is the exception, right, Michael?
It is. I was working on a book last summer, part of a book, and part of it was about Bill Graves, who had been Secretary of State. And when he ran for governor, his opponent attacked him on the grounds that the only office to which he'd ever been elected, Graves, was a minor state mm-hmm. office, and that was the Secretary of State's office. You're absolutely right. If we wanted to do like a Jay Leno move and go out on the street right now and ask who's the Secretary of State of Missouri, for example, I don't think we'd get a lot of people identifying that person. Kobach is really about Kobach more than the office.
So let me then turn to both Hunter and Celia, who have turned their attention, in part at least, to what's on the November ballot and the August 7th primary ballot for Secretary of State. A lot of the future impact of Kobach's tenure depends on who follows him in the office. And how large, Hunter, does the shadow of Kris Kobach loom over this year's race?
I think it's incredibly large. I mean, it's almost, you think of the Obama administration and the Affordable Care Act, and, you know, whoever comes in next would kind of define the future of that. In the same way, whoever comes in next for Kobach and really define what happens next with, you know, for these voting prosecutions, these cases, and really, you know, enforcement of the SAFE Act. And you look at the field, I believe, and Celia can correct me here, it's 5 Republicans and 1 Democrat. And it's been interesting seeing folks get in. You know, in the Republican field, it's a large field. You have folks like Scott Schwab, you know, who's in House leadership. You have a former, I believe, chief of staff for Governor Mike Hayden. So it's a very kind of diverse field in that sense of, you know, you don't, it's not just hyper-conservative or hyper-moderate in any way.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that field. Let's dig in. And let's start with the Democrat, the one Democrat who is on the ballot, the only candidate I've ever heard of using the nickname BAM in all capital letters on the ballot. That's Brian McClendon. What's his story, Celia?
So he is, you may know a few of the companies he's worked for. He's the former vice president at Google and at Uber. He co-founded a startup that became Google Earth. And so, you know, you'll often see references to the fact that Lawrence, Kansas is the center of Google Earth, more specifically the apartment where he grew up in Lawrence. So his story is one of going from Kansas to Silicon Valley and then coming back and now getting involved in politics.
And what's the expertise or the part of his story he cites that is important for a job that involves supervising elections and registering businesses?
So he is really selling his expertise with being able to handle all the logistics of the office, security, cybersecurity, which is for him a big issue. He is trying to get people to think a lot about what happened in 2016 with Russian hacking efforts and think about whether we can make sure that Kansas is as secure as can be. So that's one effort. But also he and quite frankly other candidates are talking about the need to improve the business filing systems, some of those systems at the Secretary of State's office that are quite frankly not quite as sexy as the elections that everyone wants to talk about. He's arguing he has the expertise to make all that happen.
Which then we go over to the Republican side of the ballot, and they also are making arguments, Hunter, in terms of who will most effectively manage the day-to-day work of the office, right?
Exactly. And I mean, the thing is, too, you know, Scott Schwab has kind of developed a large, you know, he's well known in the state.
Is the state representative, Scott Schwab, worked in insurance previously?
And, you know, and he's really, you know, kind of said, look, I just want to kind of bring some calmness back to this. And I believe, you know, when we saw the first fundraising reports, he'd fundraised the most, about $86,000, $25,000 that had come from a personal loan to the campaign. And, you know,
that's an incredibly small amount of money by a lot of other statewide races.
Right. But in a race like, you know, this, that led the field. I believe the next closest maybe had $15,000. That was Representative Keith Esau. So, you know, I think these folks are trying to figure out, you know, do you want to do this office as like a workhorse, or are you going to be kind of politicize it as Kobach did? And I'm not sure if so many people want to be the next Kris Kobach in this way. I mean, I'm not sure anybody could be the next Kris Kobach in terms of being a Secretary of State.
Well, has anyone tried to claim his mantle, said that if you supported Kris Kobach, you would support me?
You know, I sat down for lengthy interviews with all six of the candidates, and no one framed it that way. Even the three of the candidates. So I want to start by mentioning five candidates on the Republican side.
Right.
That's the most candidates we've had for this office in at least the last 30 years that I looked at. We've seen three-way primaries.
Is that itself a product of the attention Kobach has given the office?
I think that's the question, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, five people running for this office just on the Republican side, that's kind of fascinating. But so even among them, the ones who are pretty clearly linked to the same kind of policy goals as Kobach, who've either worked for him directly or had have supported the same policies that he supported when chairing the elections committees, they're not really saying like, hey, if you like Kobach, vote for me. They're more talking about, for example, what Schwab is saying, you know, bringing just a focus on getting things done in a very competent manner. Getting everything executed at a high level, I think, is the way Schwab has phrased it. So they're not trying to cash in on his reputation in that way, and that could very well be because he is such a polarizing figure.
We've mentioned the two state legislators, Scott Schwab and Keith Esau, but there's three other candidates for the Republican nomination. Dennis Taylor, who has run various state agencies. We've got Craig McCullough, who worked in Kobach's office as a fraud investigator. And then Randy Duncan from Saline County Commissioner and a longtime Republican activist. Schwab is leading the money race. Are there any other candidates who appear to be likely to get this?
Well, it's funny. I haven't seen a lot of just talk about this race, which is kind of surprising given how high-profile Kobach has made it. And when you look around, I mean, you know, I can't tell you how many political ads that I see every day. I haven't seen much in the way of this. But I'd have to think, you know, somebody like Schwab is probably leading on the Republican side, and obviously with no Democratic primary, that gives McClendon, or BAM, as he likes to be called, quite a head start to kind of build his name recognition.
You know, all of this, as we talk about the future of the office, looking at the candidates who are seeking the office, one of the things that the new Secretary of State will probably have to take care of right away is the fact that these lawsuits are still pending and not completely answered yet with what the court has directed. Is there any indication of whether the lawsuits that Kobach has been involved in will be pursued in a new administration, Michael?
I haven't heard any. Kobach did order the counties to go ahead and register voters without proof of citizenship after the court ruling. He also announced that he would appeal it. I think you make an interesting point about would the state continue to appeal this under a new Secretary of State? I think that the two Republican frontrunners, Schwab and Esau, it's kind of interesting to watch them do this sort of balancing act. On the one hand, they both remind me of the Warren G. Harding, the famous phrase, return to normalcy after World War I. We're going to have a return. I don't even know if that's a real word. We're going to have a return to normalcy in the Secretary of State's office. Just, we're going to calm things down. We're not going to be so dramatic. But they're also throwing some bones to the conservative base, saying, now, we do need to continue to keep an eye on voter fraud. And of course, McClendon's going someplace completely different with that.
It's kind of a delicate dance for the Republicans, right? You have to say, I'm not Kobach, and yet you want the people who supported Kobach to support you.
Well, it's funny, you know, like I said, it's kind of like the people running for governor. I'm not Brownback, but I kind of support Brownback's policies.
Mm-hmm. Celia, are the changes in how this office is fulfilled that have happened over the last 7.5 years, are they so tied to Kobach's personality and agenda that once he moves on, things can sort of revert back to normalcy, as Michael said, or are some of these changes actually irreversible? Has the office changed forever?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I kind of suspect that question is honestly in the hands of the voters right now, because you are seeing some candidates who are talking about the office in just a very kind of, here are the logistics the office takes care of, I just want to take care of those logistics way. I think an example is Dennis Taylor from Topeka, who's an attorney. He's just talking about, let's just get this list of duties done. Randy Duncan, the Saline County Commissioner, former County Commissioner, you know, talks about the logistics very much as a County Commissioner. I've seen how the details work of the canvassing votes, etc. And so it kind of seems like voters have a choice there of maybe, you know, do they want to continue pursuit of the same kind of ultimate policy goals, or are they more interested just in that list of duties?
Could I just throw in one?
Very quickly.
We should also talk about the Attorney General's office.
Well, okay. We'll have to save that for another show then. But I do appreciate the three of you being here to talk about this. And, of course, voters, as Celia said, will have the final word, and that comes in the primary on August 7th. Michael Smith from Emporia State, Hunter Woodall from The Star, and Celia Yopis-Jepson from Kansas News Service, thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
When we come back, have you had enough soccer yet? The World Cup may be over, but soccer in Kansas City is just heating up. We'll check in on the latest in the men's and women's game, plus some new blood coming to the athletics departments of local colleges. Greg Eklund is here with sports, so don't go away. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske. Last week on the program, Kansas City, Missouri voters are set to decide if rental properties should be subject to health department inspections. We heard the pros and cons of that initiative that'll appear on August ballots, and you can hear it at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, the public safety tax in Kansas City, Kansas will expire in 2020 unless voters choose to renew it. KCK Mayor David Alvey tells us how his community benefits from such attacks tomorrow on Up to Date. Today, the multi-year global frenzy that is the World Cup has come to an end for this cycle. We know France beat Croatia yesterday, but that doesn't mean the soccer season's over. The men's U.S. national team may not have made the World Cup, but they're thinking about the future. And meanwhile, the women's U.S. national team is number one in the world and coming to Kansas City this month. Joining us to kick around the latest news in sports is Greg Ecklin, who reports for KCUR on all things sporting. Hi, Greg.
Good morning, Brian. Should we save the expression of the day is Vive la France?
Vive la France, and it was an impressive, convincing victory yesterday.
It was, 4-2, and a long, I mean, it's kind of like March Madness. It's a month-long tournament, but it seems, you know, for those who follow the sport, that it was very much of an exciting and exhilarating match,
yeah,
and
even
a lot of developments.
Even
there.
People who don't think of themselves,
sure,
as soccer fans become soccer fans,
mm-hmm,
every few years. Let's get the talk about Team USA on the men's side out of the way quickly here. It was a painful year for the U.S. men's team. Of course, Sporting KC has a lot of connections with that team, and it failed to qualify. But hey, today is a new cycle. It's day one of World Cup 2022, right?
So, that's right.
So what's next for the U.S. team?
Well, the magic date, so to speak, then for the men's national team would be August 1st, because that's the date when the new general manager of the men's national team officially takes office. He was appointed in early June. His name is Ernie Stewart, and this is actually a new direction for U.S. soccer, because it's a position that U.S. soccer has created in light of what had happened when the U.S. failed to qualify for the World Cup tournament. So U.S. soccer is trying to get its ducks in a row. So Ernie Stewart's first order of business, looking forward, will be finding the national men's national team coach.
Is there a clear front runner for that, or does this just take some time?
Well, there are a lot of names tossed about, but I'm not sure if there's a front runner. I think Ernie Stewart probably might have an idea who he'd like to see, but it'll be an interesting call.
I'm curious, how much of the blame was laid at the feet of the coaching for the men's team not making it this time around, and how much was it simply our players didn't quite live up to their European and Latin American colleagues?
Oh, probably a combination of both. There were some formulas that and philosophies that went into the forming of the national team. It was very much a veteran team. Maybe not as much of a developmental team, and that's the direction that right off the bat, even under the interim coach, that the U.S. soccer team is taking. It's developing and turning in a new direction as far as going to a more youthful look for the men's national team roster.
Well, so as unfortunate as the men's performance was leading up to the World Cup, the U.S. women's national team has had rousing success and has a match in Kansas City later this month.
That's right.
What's the significance of that?
Well, it's a great tune-up, actually, to the CONCACAF Women's Championship, which will be taking place this fall. And that will be taking place and culminating in...
And CONCACAF is the world, the region that they compete.
Correct. Kind of, you know, North America, Central America, and those areas. And those areas, there will be 8 countries competing in the CONCACAF tournament this fall, culminating in Frisco, Texas, at which 3 of those countries will be qualified for next year's Women's World Cup in France. U.S. It right now is not locked into that World Cup berth for next year, but being ranked number one in the world certainly lends itself as one of the team favorites to come out of that that tournament this fall. So this is a great tune-up for that, because this is a match against Japan.
And this is the one that's coming up in Kansas City.
That's correct.
When
that'll
is
be
that
at,
again?
It'll be a week from this Thursday. There will be 2 matches, actually. One in the afternoon, one in the evening. USA versus Japan after 6 p.m. In the evening, and preceded by Brazil, and the other team...
Australia.
Australia, thank you for that. That will precede the match. It'll be a doubleheader match, and Japan is a very good world-renowned team. In fact, I believe in three of the four last World Championships, the USA and Japan have met each other, so this is a great litmus test moving forward.
You know, I was talking with someone here at the station with two daughters who mentioned that they'd been watching the World Cup, but one of them turned to her mom and said, where are the girls? Here's a chance for local fans to see women playing.
And no doubt. It'll be really high-caliber competition there at Sporting Park.
On the local front, Greg...
Children's Mercy Park,
of course. Children's Mercy Park, where Sporting KC plays
right.
out at the Legends at KCK. On the local front, Sporting KC has a quarterfinal match of their own this week. Speaking of Sporting, that's this Wednesday at Houston, and it's in the U.S. Open Cup. And, Greg, I have to admit, I kind of get confused about this. It seems like Sporting KC is always in a tournament for some championship, but it's not always the same one. What is the U.S. Open Cup?
The U.S. Open Cup is almost like a season within a season, where it's basically you're determining the soccer champion of this country, because it extends beyond Major League Soccer.
Okay, so there's teams in this tournament that are not in MLS.
Right, so you could have teams from the USL, or prior to it going dormant, the NASL teams were also involved. But so you would think that Major League Soccer, being the most well-known, reputable soccer league of this country, will most likely have the winner of the U.S. Open Cup. That's not a guarantee. There have been some USL teams that have knocked off MLS teams. But under the current ownership, Sporting Kansas City has won three U.S. Open Cups. It considers the U.S. Open Cup since it bears the name of Lamar Hunt. This is the Lamar Hunt U.S. Open Cup. Since it bears the name of the late owner of the Kansas City Chiefs, it's regarded as a very important tournament as far as how Sporting regards it.
And do the coaches and the players, they see it that way too?
Yeah, they do. In fact, with that in mind, here's Sporting manager Peter Vermees pointing his perspective on the importance of winning the U.S. Open Cup.
If you take our Open Cup and you compare it to any other competition around the world, in England it's the FA Cup, in Spain it's called the King's Cup, everybody has the same exact competition. And everybody in those countries, so I'll give you an example, Barcelona won the league, so they won the equivalent to our Supporter Shield, and they won the King's Cup this year. I think if Barcelona thinks it's important, I don't know how anybody in our league, or this year Chelsea beat Man United for the competition. Again, if those clubs take it as seriously as they do, I truly believe that all the teams in our league take it as serious as well.
So when Sporting sets out its three goals for the for its season, one is winning the U.S. Open Cup, one is winning the MLS Cup, which they did in 2012.
Which is a playoff system and tournament at the end
of
the season.
Basically, yes, the Major League Soccer Championship. And the third is the Supporters' Shield that he referred to. That's an award for the best record in MLS.
So you can do a sweep and win all three, and that's a really good year.
It's a very good year. Yeah, hard to top that kind of a year.
So you mentioned that this week there's a big game against Houston. This is a quarterfinal in the U.S. Open Cup. How big is this game?
Well, Houston is really one of the big rivalries for Sporting Kansas City, because it seems like if there's something important on the line, Houston is usually the opponent that determines the outcome of either. I mean, Houston has put an end to Sporting's season in the past. Kansas City has ended Houston's season in the past. And in even U.S. Open Cup competition, they've met four straight years in cup competition. So there's quite a rivalry, and so that's what makes this Wednesday's match really big.
Who's favored?
Well, you know, it's on Houston's turf. It's going to be down there in Houston. Sporting is having the better year, so I think even though they're going into a road situation, it's a match I think Sporting should win.
You know, you say that Sporting's having a better year, but they are not first place anymore in the Western Conference. Is anyone concerned about that?
I don't think so, especially with the fact that they did lose over the weekend to the New York Red Bulls, which is a very good team in the Eastern Conference, with Sporting being in the West. But one of the encouraging facets of that match over the weekend was the fact that they got Felipe Gutierrez back, and he was the MLS Player of the Month in March, and he's been out over an extended period with a sports hernia injury. But he came back over the weekend, and they also, over the weekend, did not have Matt Beisler and Aiko Parra on the back line, two premier defenders. So I still think, because of the depth of this team and the youth that they're developing, that things are looking up moving forward for Sporting.
All right. Well, let's turn from professional sports to college sports, and specifically the way college sports are run at a couple of local colleges. Greg, we talked last time we were together on the show about the firing of KU's athletic director, Shane Zanger. Now his successor has been named. Who is Jeff Long?
Jeff Long is the former athletics director at the University of Arkansas. And if you probably want to single out any name that had the most visibility of the candidates, it would have to be Jeff Long. Yeah. So they got the guy who was clearly the most visible figure.
It's a big sports school. I mean, what drew him to come to Kansas?
Well, for one thing, he's a fundraiser. He raises money, and Arkansas did a tremendous improvement process with its fundraising and upgrading its facilities. That's what KU's hoping to do specifically with the football program, but it starts with fielding a better team on the field.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. I mean, the main reason Zanger was fired was the failures of the football program. Is there really any indication that Jeff Long can be more successful?
Well, at this point, the jury is out on that, because he hired two coaches who did not work out well with Arkansas. He hired Bobby Petrino, who got himself into off-campus trouble, actually on and off campus, but it was off the football field, resulting in his firing. That was really no fault of Jeff Long. It just happened under his watch. So then he hired Brett Bielema, who was at the time anticipated as a great hire by the Razorbacks, but it just did not pan out for Bielema while he was with the Arkansas Razorbacks. And last year they finished the year with a 4-8 record. There are high expectations in Fayetteville, perhaps unrealistic expectations because of the conference that they play in. Nevertheless, it was not well accepted, and that's it. Not only cost the football coach his position, but it cost Jeff Long his job as well.
Well, which brings us then to what the expectations might be here in Lawrence. $1.5 million a year contract for 5 years. Is that par for the course, or is that as high as it seems?
Well, again, with him being the high visible figure that he is, I'm not surprised by that figure at all. He is well regarded in the athletics director community. So I think with the high expectations come highly anticipated results. And I think that's what everybody is looking for on all fronts.
Would you take the job for $1.5 million a year?
Oh, of course.
Greg, Greg is available, folks.
I didn't say that.
Well, all right. I won't offer you. KU wasn't the only school to make news this month with its athletic director vacancy. We can come all the way right here to UMKC, which, rather than announcing a hire this week, UMKC announced that it's not making a hire right away. What's going on?
Well, the significant question here is the direction that UMKC Athletics wants to take moving forward. What type of institution does it want to be with regard to athletics? That means, does it stay in the Western Athletic Conference, a conference that costs a lot of money to travel annually? Do they want to, really, the bottom line, do they want to remain a Division I institution?
Well, I mean, this is one of the first high-profile decisions that the new chancellor, C. Molly Agrawal, will have to make. How would you characterize the athletics program at UMKC up to this point?
It has had some success. Its signature program has been has had its ups and downs, but more in the last 10 years, it's been more down. And he made clear in his statement that he wants more people to become aware of UMKC. And the way to do that is to have a better, high-profile, more successful basketball program, which is its signature program.
Right, there's no football program here. Right. We should mention that KCUR is an editorially independent public service of UMKC. So the announcement actually was that instead of hiring someone, they're bringing in a consultant. The consultant is a name familiar to Mizzou fans.
Yes.
Mike Alden. What will he be working on?
Well, and let's say right off the bat that Mike Alden is not hitting the ground running with this. He has been quietly doing some work around Kansas City preparing for this. So it's not like he's going to start asking questions about the UMKC athletic program. He has already been asking those questions. So he's going to probably, on a consultant basis, make recommendations to the chancellor as to what direction they want to take. Do they want to stay in this conference? If not, what conference do they join? Do they want to stay in Division I? Those are the questions, very important questions, that a new athletics director will eventually take on.
And in your reporting and in your observation, do you have any hint of what direction you think this would go?
I think it depends on conference affiliation. I don't see any way that they could remain in the Western Athletic Conference, but if not the WAC, then where? Missouri Valley Conference is out of the question because of past track record. The Missouri Valley Conference is not interested. Perhaps the Summit, where they were before, would the Summit take them back? That's a question. Or the Horizon League? Those are all considerations, but it has to go two ways. A conference has to invite UMKC.
So before we let you go, Greg, this, of course, is the beginning today of the All-Star break in baseball. The big game is tomorrow night. It's been a rough year, Greg, for Royals fans.
Historically rough.
epically rough.
Yes. Even.
But, of course, it's all in service of a larger mission, right, which is building a better team for the future. What does it look like on the trade market for Kansas City with the trade deadline coming up at the end of the month?
Well, the biggest name that will most likely be moved in the coming weeks will be Mike Moustakas.
We're not going to be able to keep him.
Well, he signed a one-year deal, and he turned down a one-year deal that in the offseason that would have paid him more than he's currently getting. So there are no really long-term prospects of keeping him. So they're in the process of rebuilding their farm system, and moving Mike Moustakas is one of those way of restocking their farm system.
Royals are 25 games out of first place here at the halfway point. Is there any prospect of that improving in the second half?
You mean to maybe 20 games?
Well, that would be an improvement.
No, it's going to be a rough year. They're going through their growing pains. There is some promise with some of the players on the field, but they're going to continue taking their share of lumps.
But hey, Salvi Perez gets the start in the All-Star game. Not bad after missing the first 4 weeks.
He is an All-Star and deserves to be there.
That's Greg Eklund. He reports on sports for KCUR. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Brian.
On Friday's program, we learned how the passage of Proposition A, which would make Missouri a so-called right-to-work state, could affect African-American workers. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget to find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and I'm at PTS Brian. Also, you can follow KCUR on Facebook. Decades before Brown versus Board of Education was decided, young women were leading a grassroots movement to integrate public education. Tomorrow on the show, we look at 4 decades of desegregation lawsuits, all filed by women. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.